Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, I'm talking to Adam Hart about when human evolution collides with the modern world in his new book, Unfit for Purpose.
Adam Hart is an entomologist and professor of science communication at the University of Gloucestershire. He is a regular broadcaster for Radio 4, including documentaries such as Inside the Killing Jar, Big Game Theory, Raising Allosaurus, and On the Trail of the American Honeybee. He has also presented Science in Action for the BBC World Service. On television, Adam has co-presented several documentary series, most notably BBC 4's Planet Ant, Life Inside the Colony, BBC 2's Life on Planet Ant, and BBC 2's Hive Alive. Adam is also the author of more than 100 scientific papers and a previous popular science book, The Life of Pooh. And today we're going to be talking about his latest book, which is Unfit for Purpose, When Human Evolution Collides with the Modern World. Adam, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
Tell me what the idea behind Unfit for Purpose is, first of all, then.
Well, the basic idea is that we are this fabulously adapted animal. We often forget that we are animals, but we are this wonderfully adapted animal that's done incredibly well. We've achieved effective global domination. And yet, despite all of this, and despite the fact we can go into space and we can envisage subatomic particles and all kinds of other things, we still seem to have a number of woes that seem to be very much linked to the modern day world. So we have, for example, obesity, stress, violence, addiction. We've got problems with fake news and social media and all these kind of things, and just really quite deep-rooted problems, for example, the way we digest food and everything. And it's really an exploration of how some of those modern day woes are actually a sort of conflict, if you like, a sort of mismatch between this evolved animal that we are and this environment that we've made for ourselves. Because, of course, we live now in a very rapidly changing modern world environment that's got very little, in most cases, the sort of environment that we evolved in. So it's really examining those mismatches between our evolutionary heritage, if you like, and the problems of the future, or the problems of the current world. And it feels like you can see the echoes of evolution in quite a lot of the problems that we have at the moment.
Well, let's talk about that in the environment that we evolved in then. At the beginning of the book, there's a chapter long primer on evolution, which I'm not going to make you repeat, but I do want to talk about that, the sort of first point where we become something recognizable as a modern Homo sapien. When are we talking about?
Well, anatomically, modern humans, sort of Homo sapiens, are usually thought to have arisen about 300,000 years ago, although every time a new sort of bone or tooth is found, there's all kinds of jiggery-pokery about the dates. But it seems to have arisen, we seem to have sort of got to a consensus now that it's about 300,000 years. But really, when we're talking about the sort of our ability to really radically change our environment and become what we might think of now as being a very much modern human, we're really looking at sort of past about 12,000 years ago, when we went through what's called the Neolithic Revolution, which is really the development of agriculture. That was a massive, massive step in our history, because suddenly we're released from the sort of vagaries of and rhythms of the seasons, and suddenly we can start to develop what we would now recognize as civilization. You know, we have large numbers of people gathered together in a particular place. We've got sort of society-wide division of labor. You know, we're living no longer in family groups or tribes of related families, but we're living in these huge kind of cities. And now, of course, we've got cities of tens of millions of people, and that really all roots back to the fact that we developed agriculture. So definitely in the last sort of 10 to 12,000 years where we're kind of seeing the emergence of that very modern human that we would recognize now. But of course, the last 10 or 20 years have seen huge changes again with the last 30 years, perhaps with the sort of digital revolution.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the sort of time period that we're covering here, because as I said, the subtitle for the book talks about, you know, when evolution, human evolution collides with the modern world, and most of the book is talking about things that literally in our lifetimes. But as you've just mentioned, you know, there are serious changes happened to sort of humankind since the introduction of agriculture. And indeed, I want to start with a couple of things that you look at sort of going right back within that sort of period between then and now. That's the emergence of lactose tolerance and then latterly gluten intolerance.
Yeah, it's a kind of a surprising thing, but when we developed agriculture, our health took a bit of a kick, actually. We start seeing in the sort of bone evidence, we start seeing evidence of deficiencies, for example, because people's diets were much more constrained than they were when they were sort of hunter-gatherers, probably more gatherers than hunters a lot of the time. You know, we were probably hunted just as much as we were hunters, but we didn't get initially within agriculture the same sort of nutrients that we had. It introduced the idea of teeth decay, for example, and we start seeing evolution in sort of our jaw and our skulls. So that had quite a big impact. But also what we start seeing, of course, is the emergence of two big things in our diets, which we didn't have before. Lots and lots of grains and dairy. Once we started keeping animals for meat, I guess it wouldn't have been very long before we realized we could milk them. And lactose is a really interesting thing. The sugar that you find in milk, virtually all mammals can't digest once they get past infanthood. It is literally baby food. And we, of course, in Europe have this culture where we're very used to the idea of drinking milk. And we virtually come to consider that milk is good, and that milk, calcium, bone health kind of link is very, very firmly established. But we are in the minority in the world. About two-thirds of the world are actually lactose intolerant. They can't digest milk. Their enzyme lactase basically shuts off once they've been weaned, and they don't produce it anymore. So if they eat raw milk in any form, it can often make them quite ill. So we've got this really interesting evolutionary story about how in certain parts of the world with a dairying culture, that kind of dairying culture went hand in hand with the evolution of our enzymes to be able to drink the milk. And then if we can drink the milk, people started keeping more cows, and then it became more of an advantage to be able to drink milk. And you can see this pattern of lactase persistence developing through Europe, but you can also find outbreaks of it almost throughout the world where dairying has taken off. Where you don't find that lactase persistence, you also don't tend to find dairying happening. And, you know, that's what you see over in the Far East, for example, in China. But actually, a lot of those countries now are eating more and more dairy, often in the form of cheese, which is slightly easier to digest. And of course, cheese is very delicious and yummy, but if you put too much of it on your food, then you're starting to take in a lot of calories. And we throw back to another problem of the modern world, which is obesity. So that whole kind of story of the emergence of agriculture and the way that we respond to it is actually an evolutionary story. You know, we have evolved in response to a change in our environment, different types of food available that we have ourselves caused. So I guess the difference being is that now we're causing changes in our environment over a far smaller time period than we saw that gentle sort of development of agriculture over thousands of years. So we've got the capacity now to change our environment very, very rapidly.
Yeah, and this brings us to the so-called obesity epidemic that we see nowadays. This is obviously something that's happened to a significant amount of people in the world in the very recent past, evolutionarily speaking, a blink of an eye, that suddenly we have such plenty of food. I mean, obviously not everybody in the world, of course, but, you know, a significant amount of people have such a plenty of food that we never want for something to eat. And you talk about some of the ideas, some of the sort of evolutionary theories as to why we might be seeing like a sort of obesity epidemic, why we might not be built from an evolutionary perspective for such a sort of a feast. One thing is called the thrifty gene hypothesis. What's that?
Yeah, so the thrifty gene hypothesis is quite a reassuring sort of hypothesis. It's this notion that we're basically the idea is that we're famine adapted, and that in order to survive future famine, we're very, very good at laying down fat. And so we take in food, and if there's even a few calories extra, down it goes as fat. And what's happening in the modern world, according to this hypothesis, is that we are forever preparing for a famine that for many of us won't ever come. And that's quite nice in a way for people to sort of cling to, isn't it? Because it's kind of, I'm I'm fat because I'm a good metabolic Boy Scout or Girl Scout rather than, you know, any other reason. But actually, of course, first of all, even if that were true, and it doesn't seem to be the case for many populations, but if it were true, then you can't become obese if you're not surrounded by food. So it's still an environmental issue ultimately, right? You have to have plenty of food to be able to take advantage of that. But the other problem is that when people have looked for these kind of thrifty genes, actually across the world, it's been a fairly fruitless search. But what is interesting is that if you look at obesity and its incidence across the world, and you look at measures of economic well-being, so in essence, a way of measuring the amount of the modern lifestyle, that's the sort of how it breaks down, you do get a very weak relationship coming out. The more modern, if you like, and the more economically wealthy you are, the more likely you are to be obese, although there are some notable exceptions, Japan being one of them. But what you really find is a sort of cluster of countries that are very obese and relatively poor, and they all seem to cluster around the South Pacific Islands. I think 8 of the 10 sort of most obese nations in the world are South Pacific Island nations. And when people have looked there using some really good sort of genome-wide techniques, what they've found is evidence for thrifty genes and exactly the sorts of genes that you would expect with the same cellular functions that you would expect from that. And you can piece together a fairly plausible sort of evolutionary scenario where people that have populated those islands have come from mainland areas, sort of Taiwan, it's thought, and then through Indonesia. And in order to get out that far, they have to be very, very good at surviving long sea voyages, often with very poor access to food. So it's essentially selecting for people that are able to store food when they can and store fat when they can. So in those nations, it does seem that this thrifty gene sort of hypothesis is holding true, but that doesn't seem to be the case across the world. And I guess that highlights how we are. We are animals. We are just like an animal population, where, you know, a species, we're subdivided into populations with different sort of characteristics. When you look at other parts of the world, that doesn't hold. And one of the sort of counter arguments to that is something called the drifty gene hypothesis, which is an interesting hypothesis. It's still evolutionary because it's still looking at genes and gene frequency changes. But with the drifty gene hypothesis, the idea is that we have this upper and lower weight limit that's imposed on us genetically. And the lower limit stops us from basically starving to death and make sure that we've got enough resources laid down and, you know, metabolizing in that way that we can not basically die. But the upper limit is to do with keeping us lean enough to be able to survive and move and be agile and evade predators quite likely. And around about 3 million years ago, predation, a number of large predators went extinct in Eastern Africa where we were. And also at the same time, of course, we were starting to develop more socially. And then the emergence of anatomically modern humans sort of 300,000 years ago, and we start to interact more with other people. We start to become more social. Many people think that being driven by evading the predators that were around, we start to develop weapons and fire and all sorts of other things. And suddenly that upper weight limit kind of drifts, right? It doesn't matter anymore. It's not under active selection or as active selection as it was. And what's happening is that it's drifting upwards. And if you're suddenly put in an environment of plenty and you start eating, you're going to put on weight. And what you can see, of course, is the difference between different people's metabolisms, you know, responding to the different kind of drift in those genes. So that's the essence of the drifty gene hypothesis. I guess it's kind of cool that that process is called genetic drift, and you can end up with drifty and thrifty, which is a pleasing rhyme. But they're both, of course, evolutionary explanations. I guess to a certain extent, the jury's out. You know, there's still quite a lot of discussion and debate about these things. But undoubtedly, our ability to be able to lay down fat and the differences we see in different people, you know, there is going to be a genetic component to that. But when it comes down to it, if you're not stuffing food in, you can't put fat on, right? I mean, that's the basic biology of the situation. And in the modern world, we have an amazing wealth of very calorie dense food available to us at relatively low cost. I mean, you know, one of the problems with the South Pacific Island nations, for instance, was the influx of certain meat products, something called mutton flaps, which are the very fatty kind of fairly low protein parts of the carcass that you cut off from around the ribs and the stomach, and turkey tails, which are the parson's nose sort of end of the turkey, which were cut off in America and then sold down there, and they became very popular. And people ate them. And that's where much of the blame has been put, also soft drink availability. So if you've got that underlying tendency to be putting on weight, and then you're suddenly in an environment of plenty, which of course many of us are, as you said, many of us aren't, but many of us are, the inevitable will happen.
And just sort of staying with the world of eating for the moment, you also talk about sort of long-term changes inside us in terms of our gut bacteria, our own sort of biome, and how this is sort of linked with the rise of certain autoimmune diseases. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting. This is something that developed from the last book I wrote, actually, which looked at sort of our complex relationship with the bacteria. And of course, quite a big part of that is looking at our gut microbiome and our biota. And almost daily, it seems, new evidence is coming out linking the bacteria in our digestive system to all kinds of aspects of our health, but particularly to inflammation and our immune system. And as we learn more and more about it, we learn more and more that imbalances in that bacterial community inside our gut can cause all kinds of medical issues. That was kind of interesting, looking at things like asthma, for example, and allergies, but also links to things like Crohn's disease potentially and other types of bowel conditions. So yeah, looking at those links between it. And what's really interesting there is that it's not so much our evolution, but our evolved relationship with those bacteria and other organisms, actually, what become known as our old friends. It's the idea that we've evolved with a whole load of microorganisms out there in the environment. Our immune system has learned to recognize friend from foe. It's part of us, essentially. You know, these bacteria that are inside our stomachs and intestines are very, very important to us in terms of digesting our food and releasing nutrients and all sorts of other things. And now in the modern world, we've upset that balance. Lots of people sort of talk about the hygiene hypothesis and the idea that we're keeping our houses too clean. Actually, that doesn't really stand up so well. What does stand up well is that our lifestyle has changed. We don't spend as much time outside. We don't have such large families. We don't have intimate sort of, intimate's perhaps the wrong word, very close contact with livestock to an extent that we often used to. We're very much more indoor creatures now than we were. And that seems to be causing sort of knock-on effects to this sort of co-evolved relationship, if you like, with all these microorganisms. And we do start to see more and more issues that are being seen as diseases of the modern world. You know, diseases of affluence is what they're sometimes called. And they seem to reflect that lack of a balance between it. And of course, there's ways that you can restore that balance, including fecal transplants, for example, which every bit as pleasant as they sound by the sound of it. But, you know, basically trying to recolonize and repopulate your gut. But before we can do that, we have to understand and look at what a healthy gut actually looks like. What is the correct community to have in there? And it's really interesting seeing I did a radio program about this back in, I think, 2013, 2014, and talking to people there who were bacteriologists, basically, and immunologists and other things. And, you know, I was talking to them essentially as an ecologist. And what was really interesting was hearing the sorts of terms they were using, that they'd moved from sort of describing these things as bacteria almost. And now they were talking about gut communities. They were talking about exactly the sorts of interactions that you talk about in an ecological scale. And people now even refer to that sort of area inside us, if you like, as our environment, you know, really, really sort of bringing out the idea that there is a complex ecosystem inside us, and you know, we are to some extent actually simplifying that ecosystem. Actually, it seems to be the case, and when that happens, we lose function, just as we see out in the bigger world. When we simplify ecosystems in the bigger world, we tend to lose species, we tend to lose function. It's not as rich, it doesn't seem to function as well. It seems to be exactly the same with our gut bacteria as well.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thank you.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Adam Hart, and we're talking about his latest book, Unfit for Purpose, When Human Evolution Collides with the Modern World. And Adam, I want to start us off in the second half talking about stress and how stress has become a killer in the modern world. First of all, there's a sort of bodily function, a response, the acute stress response, more popularly known as the fight or flight response.
Yeah, I mean, that's an absolute lifesaver, no doubt about it. Saved my life more than once. It certainly saved me from injury many times. I'm sure it's saved you before, and probably every one of our ancestors as far back as we want to go. And actually, we can find a similar type of response in lots of different organisms as well. So this isn't a human thing. This goes far back, you know, mammals and beyond. You can even find something similar in some invertebrates. So this type of response, when something suddenly changes in response to something in the environment, is an absolute lifesaver. And it does all sorts of things to our body to make us fix the problem right here and right now. You know, most of the time we don't like change, do we? We like to bimble along pretty much enjoying ourselves as we are. But you suddenly see something out the corner of your eye, or something jumps towards you, you get that sense, that feeling, that pumped up feeling, you're amped up and ready to fight or flight. And that's really very much a lifesaver. The problem is, all those hormones that are released and then they cascade through the body actually have some negative effects on us as well. Those negative effects aren't potentially quite serious negative effects, but of course most of the time we don't see the effects of those hormones because we're not releasing them all the time. But what we see now is the problems of chronic stress. So this is not that a tiger's jumped out from behind a bush. It's that, you know, you've got a stacked up email inbox and the kids are running around outside and you've got 15 phone calls stacked up and you might miss the bus and the interest rates are falling and you're not sure whether to remortgage your house or not and your fridge has gone wrong and you've lost the guarantee and you don't know whether to renew your insurance and your car needs filling up. You know, the modern world provides us with this tremendously rich palette of stresses and micro stresses. And it's quite interesting to see that the language of medicine really has changed over the last sort of 10 or 15 years. You know, you look now at NHS websites, for example, and they're talking in language that feels, you know, feels sort of more like sort of 10 years ago would have felt more like Glastonbury than kind of Harley Street. You know, they're talking about taking spa breaks or, you know, finding time to de-stress. It's all very focused on the fact that we live these very stressful lives. And consequently, we're always in this very low level fight or flight for something that's never going to happen. And we need to address that, actually. It's causing problems. We know it causes heart problems later in life. It's linked to all kinds of other things as well. And of course, it's only really now something we're starting to learn about, because it's only now that we're seeing people who have gone through this very modern life of being stressed, which is not to say that people weren't stressed in the past, of course. There's nothing necessarily special about living a stress-filled modern life. It's just the modern world seems to provide so many more opportunities for constant low-level stress. And also, of course, it's something that we can become much more aware of now and do something about.
Let's talk about a couple of ways then in which that's really intensified in the last probably decade, let's say. Social media, first of all, the rise of social media, one thing that has done, for all the bad things that are said about, you know, Twitter or whatever, or Facebook nowadays, one thing that we might have thought was a good thing is that it has given us a much wider network of, in inverted commas, friends.
Yes, and we know that friends are good. There's all manner of studies that show just how good having a solid friendship network is. The interesting thing about social media and the thing that was almost slightly, it was slightly annoying actually writing that chapter because I wanted to come out with some sort of definitive point of social media is this or that, and it's not. It's much more complex than that. Our relationship with social media is evolving actually and changing all the time as social media does. But also different people seem to respond differently. So some people may have a very, very positive relationship with social media. It's an amazingly positive thing in their life. They get a great deal out of it. And I'm sure over the last few months, I mean, given the situations we've been living under over the last few months, social media has probably quite literally been a lifesaver for some people. However, it seems that social media can also be incredibly damaging for some people too. And there's lots of studies that sort of show that people of certain mindsets or people that are suffering from depression already or are quite ruminative personalities can be very badly affected by social media. And I guess if we're talking it from an evolutionary perspective, people sometimes kill themselves as a consequence of interactions in a virtual world. And that is obviously, from an evolutionary perspective, extremely negative, right? It reduces your fitness to zero. So it is a very interesting thing that we have created a world ourselves that is not real. It's a virtual world. It's a world that many people are now increasingly living in and spending more time in. And we still haven't really worked out the rules. And I think that's what's quite interesting, where we're almost applying real world rules to the virtual world, and that doesn't seem to work very well. And, you know, the other thing which I talk about in that chapter is the idea of the Dunbar number, or whatever number you want to use. There seems to be some upper limit to the number of people that we can have within our friendship networks because of the limitations of our brain. You know, ultimately, the limitation seems to be the number of faces you can remember. And we can see that playing out in our lives quite frequently, you know, whether it's Christmas card lists or the number of people that work in particular companies or all sorts of other things. And, you know, we see it throughout history that it seems to come out that we like to be in certain group sizes. What we're not quite sure of is how that kind of evolved psychological thought process, how that interacts between the real world and the virtual world. And that's something that's quite interesting, because there are various measures of this and various different studies that have been done. Dunbar himself came out with a number of about 135 to 150. Other studies have come out a bit higher at 400. There's one or two studies that have suggested that our limit's about 1500. But many of us on virtual networks far exceed that. And not just in terms of people that, you know, occasionally we like their posts or whatever, but actually people we interact with fairly frequently. It's quite possible to end up interacting with a very large number of people online, and then you've also got your real life networks too, and they're often quite separate. So understanding how all of these things go together and how they influence us is very much a work in progress. But I found it really interesting to see that it wasn't very much more than about 6 months, I think, after Facebook had launched, and there were already studies coming out of the Netherlands looking at the effects of Facebook on young people, for example, the influence of likes and sort of affirmation and looking at other people's lifestyle and all that sort of stuff on these social networks. So it's clear that from the beginning we've been sort of wary of them. But of course, they're everywhere. You know, people are on Instagram and Twitter and Snapchat and Facebook and all manner of things that are coming up. Every time I look, there's some new platform that's trying to get a foothold. So understanding, I think, how we interact with those things and how they interact with our regular lives or our real lives, our flesh lives, if you like, I think is very much a work in progress.
And something that wouldn't have risen to the extent that it has without social media is, as you've already mentioned, fake news. What is it about our evolutionary makeup that makes us so susceptible to it?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Sort of, I guess believing fake news is kind of an example of gullibility. And gullibility is a really, really useful trait, particularly in young children. Right? If young children don't believe what they're told, they're not going to survive very long. So we see young children developing. I mean, you can tell them that Father Christmas exists, and they do. And, you know, I mean, obviously he does. But, you know, the Tooth Fairy and so on. Children will readily believe things if it's from a trusted adult. But what's interesting is that at a very young age, we also develop heuristics and mental sort of processes that let us filter out people that are perhaps lying. But all sort of mixed in with that, you've got things like the halo effect, for example, which is a sort of psychological structure where we tend to attribute good things to people who are attractive, for example. We think that they may be more generous or more intelligent. We have no way of measuring that, but we have that thought. And it's been argued that you can link that to sort of quite deep-rooted evolutionary mate choices. The idea that we are more attracted to attractive people who generally are more symmetrically faced, and that symmetry might be a reflection of being better able to deal with parasites or having a lower parasite burden and so on. And you can find this in animals as well. So there's all kinds of little echoes. I quite enjoyed writing that chapter, actually, because it was quite an exploration of quite a few different sort of things that may or may not have a part to play. Of course, the other thing then is that we're a very social animal, and we have evolved to have structures that reinforce that sociality. I guess language is a good example of that, but also things like confirmation bias. So we're much more likely to believe good things about our group and bad things about the others. Those are exactly the sorts of things that fake news absolutely preys on. So if you've got a sort of low level of gullibility, we tend to want to believe people. We tend to want to trust people. On top of that, if you're telling, you know, if you tell someone something they already kind of believe already, they're much more prone to believe it. If you then use the halo effect and dress all that up, and I mean, I guess, you know, TV channels that seem to specialize in pumping out fairly questionable news, they look like TV channels that pump out proper news, right? So we've got all of these things lumped together. Someone seems to be telling us the truth. They look the part. They seem confident. They're all good things. They're telling us what we already kind of want to hear. Those are the absolute perfect sort of evolutionary echoes for fake news to take off. Add into that the fact that we've got a brain big enough and agile enough to have invented the internet, which is the perfect way to seed these stories around, and you've got almost a perfect storm. You know, fake news isn't new. There were examples of fake news sort of back at the beginning of the printing press and further back, actually. But what we have now is just this. I guess it's a theme actually across the book. Actually, it's this potency of the modern world, this concentrated potency. No longer is fake news just this, well, I saw this pamphlet 6 months ago, and then I read this other thing last week. You can pick up your phone and you can read 15 stories before you've got out of bed. It's that potency and concentration, I think, which is also very, very important. And I guess it's what we see in food. It's what we see in other things as well. So yeah, it's interesting that we do seem to be particularly prone to believing things that aren't true, as long as they confirm to what we think might be true.
Just to finish us off then, I mean, you talk about a whole range of different sort of issues and concerns in the book. So there's not really a what can we do about this sort of summing up answer for it. However, beyond hoping the species survives for another 300,000 years and catching up, is there anything we could do to make ourselves, especially with the sort of modern age ones that we're talking about, social media, fake news, what can we do to make ourselves less susceptible?
I think what we need to do really is just take a pause. And I suppose in some respects, we're kind of slightly being forced to do that. But we need to start thinking in a more mature way, I think, about where we want to be going. What do we want to be doing? Lots of people, for example, at the moment are questioning their work-life balance and the way that they do work, and lots of people are being forced to work from home and suddenly discovering that they can do things in a different way and operate in a different way. We need that mindset to look at these problems and understand that we can't blame evolution for these problems, and we can't evolve away from them. There are echoes of our existence as an animal, the fact that we are basically an evolved animal. We can find those echoes in lots of aspects of our life, but what we need to do is sort of own that and accept, this is what's going to happen, but maybe if we sit and think about it, we can do things differently. Because that's really, I guess, the ultimate lesson is that we have the ultimate evolutionary echo, right? We've got this fabulous brain, and it's our brain that gets us into most of these problems. And it's going to be our brain that gets us out of them. We need that time to sit and think. And the modern world has become so hectic and so kind of potent and concentrated. I think that's one of the things we lack. The other problem, which is actually the last chapter of the book, is that we don't have a very firm relationship with the future. Natural selection and evolution are very much present day events and immediate things. And it's quite interesting that psychologically we don't seem to have got a very good grip on the future. We don't treat future us in the same way that we treat present day us, for example. We tend to devalue future us. But we can be trained out of that. So there's a whole series of quite interesting experiments where people have sort of primed subjects to realize that, well, hang on, future you, that you're about to lump all this pain and suffering on to avoid it now, future you is actually you. It's going to be the same person. You're going to have the same hopes and fears and so on. And that causes people to rethink. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, I sort of didn't set out to write a sort of species self-help book, more of a sort of playful exploration of some of our evolutionary past. But actually, I think having an understanding of that could help in the long run. For example, there's a gambling therapy. I talk about addiction and sort of problem gambling in one of the chapters. And one of the treatments for that is actually to make people understand why they gamble in evolutionary terms, to understand about the importance of risk. So you can be very risk averse. You're a little mouse that hides away in your hole and never goes out to feed or mate. You're not going to do very well. On the other hand, you can be a very brave and confident mouse that spends all your time outside your hole and you get eaten by a bird. So you have to balance these things out. And actually treating people and talking to people and making them understand that actually there are these choices, there are these evolutionary choices, your brain is conspiring against you, there are these reward pathways, that can help people to get a grip on their behavior a little bit too. So I think, sometimes knowledge is power, right? Sometimes understanding why we are where we are can help us to think through the next step, which is very clearly where we are right now.
So I've been talking to Adam Hart. We've been talking about his book Unfit for Purpose: When Human Evolution Collides with the Modern World, which is out now from Bloomsbury. Adam, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thank you.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.